You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Each of us is host to about 100 trillion bacterial cells, 10 times the number of human cells that make up our bodies. These bacteria are called our microbiome, a complex ecosystem of microorganisms that play an important role in keeping us healthy. In a new book called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues, Dr. Martin Blaser, director of the Human Microbiome Program at NYU, explains how these healthy bacteria function and examines how antibiotics are harming them, leading to a serious increase in obesity, type 1 diabetes, asthma, allergies, celiac disease, and ulcerative colitis. His book is published by Henry Holt, and I'm very pleased to welcome Martin Blaser back to our show. Welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Can you describe these trillions of microbes? Where are they found, and how many different microbes are there in any typical human?
Well, just as you said, most of the cells in the human body are microbes. They're not human cells. They're bacteria. They're fungi. They're protozoa. They're all over the body, in our gastrointestinal tract, on our skin, in our eyes and ears, in our mouth, in women, in the vagina. These are the most numerous population in our body.
Inside and outside,
inside
obviously.
Inside and outside.
So do we know where they come from? Are we born with them?
It's an interesting question. In the womb, we're pretty much sterile. And as we start being born, we're introduced to the world of bacteria. As we pass through the birth canal, we're coated with our mom's bacteria. And then we're exposed to mom's bacteria all through the early days of life.
Doesn't a woman's microbiome change during pregnancy?
It does. The microbiome changes in ways that are not accidental. It's a kind of coevolution, because moms have to pass on not only their own genes, but their microbial genes to the next generation.
So the child develops starts getting the microbes as it goes through the vaginal canal. What about when there's a C-section?
It's different. The babies who are born by C-section, they start off life with a different microbiome. If they're born vaginally, all the places that you sample in the baby look like vagina, at least to start. But if they're born by C-section, it looks like skin, and not even the mom's skin. It could be somebody else's skin.
Well, babies are washed off immediately in the hospital. Do you think that's a good idea?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that.
Well, 1 in 3 babies is born by cesarean section. Do you know if this difference has caused immune system problems in people later in their lives?
1 out of 3 in the U.S. as a total. Here in Manhattan, it's about 1 in 2. In other parts of the world, 1 in 2. In Rome, it's 80% of the kids are being born by C-section today. Huge scale. And this has come up over the last 20 or 30 years. So to answer your question, there now have been studies showing that kids born by C-section are more likely to become obese, to develop type 1 diabetes, to develop celiac disease. There's a growing body of literature that having a C-section may have some long-term costs.
Is there anything we can do to compensate for that? Give the baby something very early? Or does breastfeeding compensate for it to some degree?
My wife is a scientist as well. Her name is Maria Gloria Dominguez, and she has been studying the relationship between the microbiota in vaginally born and C-section born babies and found this difference. And she's doing a study right now with 3 groups of moms: vaginal birth, C-section birth, and C-section birth with restoration of the vaginal microbiota via swab. The study's in progress. She's going to present some of her first results at a national meeting this month.
You give us a hint at what you think she's going to say?
I wouldn't know.
What makes one strain of bacteria a pathogen that's harmful to us while other bacteria play a major role in keeping us healthy?
Yeah, that's a great question. The answer is very long. And the complicated thing is that some of the organisms that keep us healthy can sometimes become pathogens. And some of the organisms that are pathogens also have beneficial roles. So the boundary is not exactly defined. There are some organisms that are very bad, like the bacteria that causes tuberculosis. But many of the bacteria in the normal human body are generally beneficial to us, but they have the capability of doing harm to us.
Well, the ones that change, and we'll go into more detail later, Do we know, do they change or do we change and have a different reaction to them?
Well, my book is about the idea that we have an ancient microbiome, that it's been with us for eons, just as all other animals have had ancient microbiomes, and that over the course of the 20th and now the 21st century, our microbiome is changing, and that we are losing diversity, that we're losing some of our ancient organisms. And, of course, I believe that that has consequence.
We're losing them because of things like C-sections and then antibiotics?
Yeah, it probably began in the late 19th century, maybe with clean water. Clean water protects us against pathogens, but it also prevents the flow of our normal organisms from one person to another.
We have done shows where doctors have said that using antibiotic soaps may not be the best idea because we actually need exposure to bacteria to build up immunity to them.
Yeah, that's what's called the hygiene hypothesis. And my hypothesis is a little different from that. But the idea about the antibacterial soaps and the hand sanitizers that are being used by the tens of millions.
We have them all over our station here.
They're everywhere. And it's important to use them if you're in a hospital where there are some really bad germs. It's important to use them during flu season. But the other 95% of the time, there's no clear benefit. And in fact, the question is, are they doing more good or more harm?
How did the Human Microbiome Project take an inventory of all the microbes?
The Human Microbiome Project is a project funded by our tax dollars through the National Institutes of Health, through their common fund. They devoted about $140 million to study many aspects of the human microbiome. And one part of it was to study about 250 healthy people in the South and the Midwest. That's where they selected them, to see what are the organisms that they carry in 19 different sites of their body. And they developed the beginning of a catalog.
And you say that we are losing some of the ones that we had in the past. How do we know that?
Well, we know that by inference. We know that by comparing peoples in the U.S. with peoples who have not had the same level of development as us, people in Africa and Amerindians in Latin America. There's more and more evidence that our diversity is going down, 15%, maybe as high as 40% loss.
My guess is Dr. Martin J. Blaser, his book, Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. Well, what are some of the good things that microbes do for us? We know about the bad things, the things that make us ill.
Yeah, so the good things include the microbes train our immunity. They help us digest food. They make vitamins for us. They help protect us against invaders.
So they're actually, when they help protect us against invaders in the way that white blood cells help protect us?
We more and more think about the microbiome as a third arm of our immunity. There's innate immunity. There's adaptive immunity that recognizes new foreign things. And then there are microbes. They're protecting the home turf, and they're not letting invaders come into the home turf.
So when we have autoimmune problems, is that because of an imbalance of microbes?
It could be. It could be. That's certainly part of the theory.
Well, let's get to the matter of overuse of antibiotics, because that's a major part of what you talk about here. What is the appropriate use of antibiotics, and when do we know when we're overusing them?
Yeah, so this is a very important question, and as you say, one of the central themes of the book. Antibiotics are miraculous. Antibiotics have saved countless lives. With people who have severe infections, there is nothing like antibiotics. On the other hand, since their discovery and deployment 70 years ago, we're using them more and more and more for milder and milder conditions, conditions so mild that maybe we don't need them at all.
Well, there was a time when people were being prescribed antibiotics when they had a cold, which is a viral problem, and antibiotics don't work on viruses. But we were told that wasn't a good idea. Doctors have stopped doing that, haven't they?
They haven't. They have not. And in fact, now, still, when a child who comes in with an ear infection, it's just like the cold. 70 to 80% of those ear infections are due to viruses. Antibiotics don't even work. Yet, 70% of the time, the child walks out of the doctor's office with a prescription for an antibiotic.
Well, whose fault is that? Is that because the doctor doesn't know, or because the parent insists.
It's everybody's fault. It's everybody's fault because we're not counting the consequences of antibiotic use. We're just seeing the benefit. We're not seeing the long-term cost.
Even if we're not prescribed antibiotics, aren't we exposed to them in the environment and in the food that we eat?
We are. And this is another one of the main themes of the book. Soon after antibiotics were developed, farmers discovered that if they fed low doses of antibiotics to their farm animals, they would gain weight. They would grow. This is what was called growth promotion. And it is widely done in the United States because it works.
So they weren't giving it to them to prevent them from getting sick?
They were not. This is subtherapeutic doses of antibiotics, low doses of antibiotics.
Well, if we're given low doses of antibiotics humans, do we also gain weight?
Well, most kids aren't given low doses. Most kids are given therapeutic doses. And we've been working in my lab at NYU for the last 10 years to answer this question by studying mice, where we give antibiotics to mice early in life and we ask, what will happen to their weight? What will happen to their development? And we've shown that they grow bigger and they grow fatter.
And how has this widespread use of low-dose antibiotics led to drug-resistant bacteria, as we've been hearing?
That as well. I mean, there are many different aspects to this story, but we're awash in a sea of antibiotics, either passively through our food and water at very low doses or deliberately treating those ear and throat infections that are so widely done.
Well, we're talking about it as it affects humans, but what does this use of antibiotics do to the microbiomes of cows and pigs?
Antibiotics, their job is to inhibit or kill bacteria. So when they're used, they select for resistant organisms. And whenever you use an antibiotic, the population of resistant organisms grows. So the population of resistant organisms is greater in our farm animals. And it transfers over to humans to some extent through our food.
My guest is Dr. Martin Blaser, who studies the role of bacteria in human disease. He's been doing that for over 30 years, and now he's written a book called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling our Modern Plagues. It's published by Henry Holt. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Martin J. Blaser. He's written a book called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. It's published by Henry Holt. Do we use antibiotics more in this country than people do in other parts of the world?
We are using a phenomenal amount of antibiotics. Last year, the CDC published a paper on antibiotic use in the United States in 2010. They found that there were 258 million prescriptions for antibiotics in our population of 300 million. That's 5 prescriptions for antibiotics for every 6 people. And the evidence is that this has been going on year after year after year. So what that means is that the average child in the United States, by the time they're 3, they've had 4 courses of antibiotics. And by the time they're 10, they've had 10 courses. And by the time they're 20, they've had 17 courses of antibiotics. And we don't have to do that because a few months later, scientists in Sweden published their results. And first, I'll remind you that the Swedes are at least as healthy as we are. And at every age, they're using 40% of the antibiotics we're using. So when our kids have had 4, they've had 1.4. And when our kids have had 10, they've had 4. So it suggests immediately that 60% of the antibiotics we're using are unnecessary.
So they're treating illnesses differently than we do.
Yes.
Obviously.
With much less reliance on antibiotics.
Well, we talk a lot about the overuse of antibiotics leading to drug-resistant bacteria. But it also is a problem because when you use them, you're killing the bad bacteria, but you're also killing the good bacteria in your body. Are there ways of replenishing the good bacteria? I've been told something like yogurt or other probiotics can help, but I can't imagine eating that much yogurt when I'm taking a big dose of penicillin.
Well, also, if we're losing hundreds of strains of bacteria, eating yogurt of one kind isn't necessarily going to help us.
And you could eat all the different brands. They have a lot of sugar in them.
It's not enough. And we think also there's a developmental window that the timing when you acquire your microbes and if you happen to lose them is really critical.
So if you've had a course of penicillin as a young child, is it likely that your microbiome has been altered permanently?
I believe so. I believe that that's true. I can't prove that at this point, but we have indirect evidence that's supporting that. And now, if you have thousands of species and you lose one or two, maybe that's not so bad. But I think that it's actually cumulative, that every time we take antibiotics, we lose species.
Well, I mentioned earlier the autoimmune system. You point out that the rise of chronic autoimmune diseases is linked to antibiotics. Has that been proven?
Well, this is work that we and others are doing. We have evidence that the more courses of antibiotics that kids take, the more likely they are to get asthma. Actually, this is work published from Canada that showed antibiotic use in the first year of life increased the risk of kids having asthma when they were seven.
And do we know why?
The presumption is because it's affecting the microbiome during a critical developmental window.
You're an expert on the bacterium Helicobacter pylori, H. pylori. Where is it found and what does it do?
Helicobacter pylori is a bacteria that lives in the human stomach. It's the dominant organism in the human stomach, or at least it was since time immemorial. But over the course of the 20th century, it's rapidly been disappearing. So that in 1995, national surveys that we did showed that fewer than 6% of children had it. And studies elsewhere in Europe show the same things. This bacteria that everybody used to have has largely disappeared over the course of a century.
Well, since it's also been a cause of ulcers and gastric cancer, isn't that a good thing?
It's both good and it's bad. Helicobacter was discovered as a pathogen causing ulcers. The scientists who found that won the Nobel Prize.
They used to think that it was stress and stomach acid.
And they still play a role, but Helicobacter is pretty much necessary for ulcers. And we and others did studies that showed Helicobacter was a major cause of stomach cancer. So it was firmly on the map as a pathogen. But the more I studied it, the more I began to see that it may have some benefits, that it's really an ancient organism that's involved in our physiology. And we began to find it.
Part of the digestive system?
Part of the digestive system. As Helicobacter's been disappearing, ulcers have been disappearing, gastric cancer's disappearing, but new diseases are rising, like reflux or esophageal reflux or GERD. It has many different names. Or
heartburn?
Or heartburn. They've been rising dramatically as Helicobacter has been falling. And we and others have found a very strong relationship indicating a protective role of Helicobacter against these diseases.
And are you suggesting it's disappearing because parents have taken antibiotics and then they're passing on less of it to their children?
That's part of it. But in fact, the disappearance began before antibiotics were even invented. Helicobacter probably began going away in the late 19th century. Maybe it has something to do with clean water, smaller families, cesarean sections, antibiotics. It's all cumulative.
And this is the bacteria that you mentioned earlier that is beneficial in our early lives but can then cause health problems later?
That's my reading of the science, and that's what our experiments show.
But do antibiotics play a role in that shift?
In part, one of the reasons is why Helicobacter is disappearing, and certainly antibiotic use is accelerating its disappearance. And in 1998, I predicted that we would give Helicobacter back to children, young children, so that we could get the early life benefits, and then maybe when people are 30, 40, 50 years old, eradicate it so we miss the late-in-life cost. That's still a hypothesis. I was just yesterday at a meeting of gastroenterologists in Chicago. They didn't like the idea at all, but I still think it's true.
They don't like the idea because you're giving some people something that can cause trouble and then saying, well, we'll fix it later.
They're still focusing on the cost of Helicobacter. I'm looking at the early life benefit, and there's also benefit in relation to asthma as well.
Well, we've seen a major increase in celiac disease, or at least reports of celiac disease, also Crohn's disease, in recent years. And you write about your daughter developing celiac disease. You see it also linked to antibiotics?
As I describe in the book, she had a lot of ear infections as a child. She got a lot of antibiotics, developed some allergies. And then she went off to save the world to Latin America, where she worked very hard. She was under bad conditions. She got a lot of infections. She got a lot of antibiotics. And that's when her troubles began.
Well, why would it lead to an extreme sensitivity to gluten?
Because this gets into the whole theory of allergy. And if normal people encounter an allergen, we may get an allergic response, but we can shut it off. But if you don't have regulatory cells to shut the switch off, then it can continue. And that could be a skin allergy, it could be a food allergy, it could be asthma. It's really the inability to shut off the allergic response that's important.
So celiac disease is a severe allergic reaction to certain things in certain flours.
That's right. Celiac disease is an allergy to a protein in wheat called gluten. Many people have allergies to it.
So does the microbiome play an important role in shutting this allergic response off?
Well, you remember that the microbiome helps train the immune system, and it helps set up the populations of cells early in life that will guide the baby and then the child through life. And the question is, do they set up having regulatory cells or aggressive cells or allergic cells? We think that's the frontier.
Some people who don't have celiac disease have switched to gluten-free diets. Is there any medical justification for that?
I'm not sure.
We also have a number of listeners who have written in wondering about nut allergies.
I think the remarkable thing about nut allergies is how rare they were and how common they're becoming. And again, this is why I wrote Missing Microbes, because we have about 10 different diseases that have come up simultaneously over this period since World War II, since antibiotics and other practices have been around. Either they have 10 different causes, or perhaps there's one cause that is fueling all of them, and I think that's the change in our microbiome.
Well, people who would dismiss the kind of thing you're saying would say we're just diagnosing these things better than we did in the past.
And to some degree that's correct, but there have been careful studies looking at many diseases seeing that there is some overdiagnosis of a number of diseases, yet there is a nubbin of disease that's clearly gone up dramatically with celiac disease. Juvenile diabetes, which is very hard to misdiagnose, is doubling every 20 years.
Martin J. Blaser is the director of the Human Microbiome Program at NYU. He served as the chair of medicine at NYU and the president of the Infectious Diseases Society of America. He's written a book called Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. It is published by Henry Holt. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So does it look likely that the microbes that protect us from allergic responses are disappearing and leading to autoimmune disorders like celiac, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease?
We began our work with Helicobacter pylori, which was clearly disappearing. And after we showed that evidence that Helicobacter was protecting the esophagus against reflux, we turned to asthma and to atopic dermatitis. We found evidence for that. Investigators with animal models found evidence for that. And also we found evidence working with a group here at Columbia University. We found evidence for a protective role of Helicobacter in celiac disease as well.
You mentioned an increase in type 1 diabetes. What are your thoughts on why that's happening?
Type 1 diabetes is an allergic disease. It's an autoimmune disease. And again, this has to – and what we know is type 1 is increasing, and it's also getting younger. Kids are getting it. The average age used to be 9. Now it's moving down to 6. Some kids are getting it when they're 2 or 3. It's clearly happening very early in life, just at the period when the microbiome should be developing normally, but we're putting all these obstacles in its place.
But others would argue that it's simply that we have more and more sugar in our diet.
That's important for type 2 diabetes. Type 1 diabetes is generally accepted to be a disease of autoimmune destruction of the pancreas.
There's an infection called C. difficile that's severe, hard to treat. Is it directly caused by antibiotics?
It is indeed. And it's hard to pronounce, so we call it C. diff. And that's an infection that comes about in people who've had antibiotics. It's an intestinal infection. It causes severe diarrhea. It can be treated with antibiotics, but sometimes it can't be treated.
It's often treated in an odd way with fecal transplant.
So sometimes it comes back again and again, and it can't be eradicated. And sometimes, unfortunately, people die from this. And going back 50 years, doctors have found that if they instilled normal feces into a person with C. difficile infection, that they could cure it. There was recently a study in the Netherlands that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine comparing conventional therapy and fecal transplant, and they actually had to stop the trial because the fecal transplant was so much better than the conventional therapy.
That's because the feces have good bacteria in them?
Because the feces have good bacteria, they have a normal ecosystem.
Now, obesity is another thing. That's not an autoimmune problem. Why are you linking it to the destruction of the microbiome?
For me, it goes back to the observation that farmers have been feeding antibiotics to their farm animals to help them gain weight. About 10 years ago, a light bulb went off, and I said, if they're doing that, what are we doing to our kids? Could the antibiotics we're giving our kids be promoting their growth? And that's why we began to do experiments in mice.
So is this really a matter of just indiscriminate use of antibiotics? Can we do a better job if we have more targeted antibiotics, or should we be cutting down on their use altogether?
I think we should be cutting down on the use altogether. As I told you, 60% of the use is probably unnecessary. But in the future, I think the medicine of the future will require targeted narrow-spectrum antibiotics. Up to now, the whole focus is broad-spectrum antibiotics.
Like amoxicillin.
Amoxicillin, the Z-Pak, many other antibiotics that are widely used, because you don't have to – somebody who's ill doesn't come in with a sign, I have this organism or I have that organism. So the doctor can treat with a broad-spectrum antibiotic. But once we begin to understand that antibiotics have cost because of the collateral damage – we're treating the pathogen, but we're damaging the good guys. Then we begin to think we should develop narrow-spectrum antibiotics. And we're going to need better diagnostics also, so that when a child comes in with an ear infection, we can say, this child has a virus, we don't need antibiotics. This child has a bacteria, and now is it bacteria A, B, C, or D? We're going to find out in real time, and then we're going to take off-the-shelf narrow-spectrum antibiotic targeted to A, B, C, and D. That's my prediction for the future.
Well, who do you think is going to have to affect these changes? Is it going to be the AMA? Is it going to be just doctors reading medical journals? Can you educate the public to the fact that they shouldn't be taking as many antibiotics? And even if I decide I'll never take another shot, unless it means life or death, aren't I still eating a lot of antibiotics just simply because the food I eat often contains it?
That's why I wrote Missing Microbes and why I'm so happy to be on your show, because I want to educate the public about the costs and risks of antibiotics so that an informed public will – and inform doctors also, and I'm speaking to doctors all the time to explain to them that antibiotics are not free. We've been giving them a green light for all these decades, but it's been a mistake. Antibiotics have a cost. We have to factor that into all our decisions, and we're going to have to come up with those narrow-spectrum antibiotics and with the new diagnostics. It's going to take a lot of money, but I'd rather pay for it now than pay later in the clinic.
Well, how are your ideas being received within the medical community?
I'd say pretty well. I've been invited at many important forums, and people seem interested in what I'm saying. In a way, it's kind of obvious. You can't have agents this powerful and not have consequences.
Can we develop probiotic supplements? There are some already. Are they beneficial?
There are many probiotic supplements. You go to the health food store, the grocery store, the supermarket. The shelves are filled with them. But I can say three things. First, they're generally safe. Secondly, they're hardly regulated. And third is that they've hardly been tested. So I don't really know what to say about them, the current probiotics. I think that probiotics are going to be an important part of our future, but it's going to be the ones that we develop scientifically based on clinical trials and experiments.
Could we treat allergies by exposing people to bacteria?
If we understood the right bacteria and the right timing, I think it could be very important for treatment of allergies.
What are the biggest questions you still have?
Well, there are a lot of questions. How does early life antibiotics change metabolism so that kids are getting bigger? How does it affect immunity? What are the effects of the change of the microbiome on the developing brain? How does that have an effect?
Dr. Martin J. Blaser, his book, Missing Microbes, How the Overuse of Antibiotics is Fueling Our Modern Plagues. It is published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
My pleasure.